39.
Oh, yeah. I'm making a list of things I'm falling behind.
Me too, falling behind. No.
All right. Okay, got it. Out. This, I want to talk to you about something.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
It's wait. Oh, we're getting worse. Yesterday last time we started 10 minutes late. Now it's 12 minutes late. Welcome. We are convening the Wednesday, March 12, 2014 Policy Committee for Transportation and Public Safety. Four bills on the agenda. We'll start with Senate File 1919. Senator Saxhog, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As the Chair has stated, today we're presenting Senate File 1919. This bill will make some minor changes to the state's procurement statutes to ensure that when public entities are hiring construction contractors, they're hiring contractors who follow the law. The vast majority of construction contractors follow the rules. Those who skirt the law in order to win bids and cost taxpayers money and get an unfair advantage of the bidding process are who we're aiming at and who we're trying to fix here in Senate File 1919. With me today is Harry Melander, Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, Kyle Macarius, Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. And they're going to try to explain the bill a little bit and answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Saxhog. Who would like to go first?
Senator?
Mr. Melander, thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I work as the chair of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. I've been asked to be brief in my comments, and I'll do so. We think this bill will provide a benefit to the state. We think that it provides a mechanism that doesn't exist now within the public bidding law, and we believe that it also will provide a very, very useful tool to greater Minnesota communities as well as folks in the metro area. So I will leave it at that. Kyle Macarius is going to go briefly and describe the bill, and then I guess we'll just open up for questions unless you have some to me.
Great. Okay? Thank you. Greetings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name is Kyle Macarios. I work for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. As Senator Saxhog mentioned, while most contractors in the state of Minnesota follow the law, it is too common to find contractors who violate the law end up working on taxpayer-funded projects even after they've been found to have violated the law. When these contractors work on projects that are funded by our taxpayers, not only are they cheating the taxpayers, they're often cheating their employees. They're cheating the taxpayers, and they also get an unfair advantage through their unscrupulous activities over other law-abiding contractors. This bill is a modest attempt to keep contractors who don't play by the rules off of projects that are funded by the public. Here's how this bill will attempt to help the situation. Contractors that bid on work from state or local government will have to sign a statement under oath that they meet a set of minimum criteria. All of these criteria are in current law. They'll have to verify that they comply with and have not had any recent violations of these laws, such as requirements to pay workers' compensation and unemployment and to have a tax ID number. They can't have had major violations of a series of wage and hour laws, including overtime, child labor, and prevailing wage requirements. They can't have violated a municipality's requirements for payment of wages on a recent contract. They must abide by laws prohibiting illegal subcontracting schemes, payroll fraud, and employee misclassification. They can't have current tax liens. They can't have operated under a false front as a disadvantaged business. They can't be currently debarred by the federal government, the state, or any local government. That is the criteria. These criteria are all in current law. We tried very hard to craft this bill so that there's very minimal administrative burden on either legitimate employers or on our public agencies. Contractors simply have to sign a statement that they meet these criteria. Public agencies only have to receive it. If it turns out that a contractor submits a false statement, then they're in breach of contract and are ineligible to work on public contracts for 3 years. The goal here is to try to get taxpayer projects to operate the way you or I would operate if we were hiring somebody to work on our house, or the way a private business would operate if they were hiring a contractor to build a facility for them. If we set a series of rules and standards about how we wanted our house built or how we wanted our business built, and a contractor didn't meet them, we're not going to hire that contractor back. We're suggesting that the taxpayers do similar standards and don't hire contractors who have cheated on the rules before. We recognize that this is there's a fine line between catching not allowing contractors who are unscrupulous to work on taxpayer projects and not catching legitimate employers who make innocent mistakes. And so we're in a series of discussions with a bunch of contractor associations. We haven't quite perfected the language and drawn that line in the exact right spot, but we are very diligent in working with a number of contractor associations to draw that line in the right spot. I think you'll hear from some of them today. It feels to me like we have agreement in principle with a number of contractor associations on the principles here, but we are working very diligently to make sure we get the language perfect. Committee members, with that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Makarios. Questions, members? Senator Champion.
Mr. Makarios, can you tell me, based on Senate File 1919, what happens if a person fails to comply with goals or fails to demonstrate good faith? What happens to them, if anything, under Senate File 1919?
Senator Champion, you're referring to like DBE goals and,
yes.
and that?
Yeah.
Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion. This would not change the way that the state or any other public agency deals with contractors who fail to meet goals or make good faith effort toward meeting those goals. So for state this, of course, one distinction here is this applies to all public contracts, not just contracts by the state or by a municipality, but any contracts let by public agencies. And of course, as you know, Senator, different public agencies enforce these goals in different ways and enforce good faith efforts in different ways. So it's a tough one, but this bill does not directly address that issue.
So,
Senator Jim.
So really what you're saying to me that it's possible for a contractor to fail to meet those goals or even demonstrate any good faith, and it's not one of the criteria that you've laid out in Subdivision 3 that would make them ineligible for being a part of a public project. Is that what you're really saying?
Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Champion. Thank you for that question. We put significant thought into this question, of course, and have run this language early on by the Department of Human Rights and came to the conclusion that that would be a tough issue to negotiate here. And so we did not include it in the minimum criteria. You're correct that it's not included in the minimum criteria.
So with that, Mr. Chair, well, maybe I should ask this question. So can you tell me when that language, if any language, is going to be negotiated and a part of this contract, and whether you believe that we should wait until that language is a part of this agreement before we move it on from this committee and go to another one?
So either Senator Saxhog or Mr. Makarios can respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Champion. I this bill does not solve all of the problems in the construction industry. There are many problems in the construction industry. Failure to make good faith effort is certainly a problem in the construction industry. But that is not a problem we're attempting to address with this bill, Senator. to be frank. I think that the Department of Human Rights is doing very good work on trying to address good faith efforts independently, and they never expressed to us interest in including that as a minimum criteria. As I mentioned, we showed them our very first draft of this bill before we filed it and had conversations with Commissioner Lindsay and never got from them an indication that they thought it ought to be included as a minimum criteria. So our preference, I think, is to take the modest step forward with what we have here and continue to work on the other problems we have in the construction industry.
Mr. Chair, I could go on and on with this, and I'm going to not do that, but say that I think it's problematic for this bill not to have that that language here, mm-hmm. and for there to be a real concentration from the industry around addressing that matter. I know, and I can respect Mr. The testifier's, you know, words around you can't solve every problem, but some problems are glaring problems that need some attention, mm-hmm. And that need some reaction in real time. And so with that, I believe that the bill is problematic. Without it, I believe that the bill is problematic.
Great. Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, I think we just heard Mr. Macario testify that there will be significant changes to this bill after this committee. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I'll have to defer to Mr. Macario on what he said, but my interpretation is that the different stakeholders have gotten together and have come to somewhat of a meeting of the minds. Whether that's whether I consider that to be dramatic, I'd have to defer. But I think you're right in that there probably will be some minimum changes here to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog. I think I do have the same concerns expressed by my colleague, Senator Champion. Would you be willing to table this bill until you have it in the form that would allow this committee to view it before it moves forward? I'm comfortable. I would not support this bill as it is right now. I'm not sure where other members are. I don't even think we have a quorum right now, do we, with eight? We do have a quorum.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not comfortable supporting the bill as it is, certainly when I think I just heard that there's going to be significant changes in committees. I have a responsibility to represent my district in every bill that comes before me in each committee I have responsibility for. And if there's any way you'd consider tabling it until we see that so-called agreement, I know I would be grateful.
Senator
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I think that we're close enough, so I would like to keep this moving on to the next committee if we can get some meeting of the minds. But I believe it's close enough and close enough to the purpose and the goal that we've all established that it should keep moving. And no, I would not table it.
Okay. I have a follow-up.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of the things, Mr. Macario, many of the things you described in terms of a good contractor in this bill are required to get a performance bond. What in this bill is added right now that isn't required by a contract to get a performance bond to cover the potential of a poor contractor not paying their bills?
Mr. Macario.
Senator Dibble, Senator Peterson, thank you. I frankly am not sure. I mean, I'm not a contractor, so I've never gotten a performance bond. I'm not certain about the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Saxog, do you have any general contractors that are affected by this? Are they going to testify in favor of this bill?
Well, there's going to be some people that are contracting, but having been in the insurance business for 36 years in the bonding business and have bonded for contractors, I know that contractors that are guilty of the things that we're trying to prevent here, and it's public information, probably wouldn't be granted a bond.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the thing that I see in my short review of this this bill relates specifically to the requirement and the penalties for the prevailing wage or potential prevailing wage violations. Otherwise, I would say any of the other requirements, in my view, that are listed in this bill, if the contractor was not doing those things, an insurance company wouldn't sell them a performance bond, and they would essentially be out of business. And so my view, interpretation of this specifically relates to the penalties surrounding prevailing wage violations, which we know many times are not intentional. I see you nodding your head. Prevailing wage violations mostly are not intentional. And so, Senator Sacksog, I hope you would consider just tabling this bill till we see the language that you intend to move forward in other committees.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sacksog.
Senator Peterson, I think Mr. McCarthy would probably like to answer a few of the statements that you just offered.
Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Peterson, you're absolutely right. There are inadvertent violations of prevailing wage. I'm not sure I would agree with you on mostly inadvertent, but certainly there are inadvertent prevailing wage violations, which is one of the obviously significant areas that we're in discussions with contractors to make sure that we are trying to draw a line between what is a major violation and what is what would be considered an inadvertent violation. So to answer your other questions about, you know, kind of the depth of any amendments that might come forward, I would say that there are not considerations that would majorly change the prime focus of this bill or the way it would operate. Where we are working on ironing out the rough edges tend to be around this very question: what is the right what is the right line between an inadvertent violation and a deliberate or major violation or repeated violation? What is the liability for a general contractor if a subcontractor on their job commits a violation or a false sworn statement? So I would say that what we are working on is the more technical aspects and working on drawing a line between what we consider inadvertent or minor violations and more significant violations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Senator Sacksog and Mr. Makarios. I see one of the other requirements you have here is that these penalties would kick in at the $10,000 mark. How many hours does an average carpenter have to work to make $10,000?
Well, you put me on the spot to do math.
That's one of the. I didn't have the answer to that question myself ahead of time. Maybe I should have. But six weeks. So, in Senator Sacksog, in the language that you believe is coming to you for future committees. Is that threshold of $10,000 for the penalty, is that intended to be raised or lowered? Or
Senator Sacksog.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I believe that will be one of the things that will be the same.
Okay, thank you. As Senator Champion mentioned, I could go on as well, but I guess I'm interested in hearing the rest of the testimony. So.
All right. Senator Champion, do you want to offer? Senator Champion has an idea for an amendment.
I have an idea for an amendment, and I would move to insert after line 3.13, insert this language. I know it's kind of long, but it should be something like the contractor, comma, vendor, comma, or related entity has not within the 3-year period before responding to the solicitation document, comma, failed to meet established disadvantaged business enterprise goals due to a lack of good faith effort.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
An extensive verbal amendment like that, I think we have to at least take time to have it put in writing.
Okay, we can do that. Okay.
I don't mind putting it in writing, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
All right, well, so council will help us get that done. We'll pause on that and take additional testimony at this point. Oh, I'm sorry. Does anyone have questions right now for Senator Sacksog or the witnesses? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, a few questions. Senator Sacksog, Senator Peterson expressed some concern, and One statement in here is a violation is if they failed to represent their employment. Let me look at it here. If they've misrepresented their employee relationship, what exactly are you referring to there?
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, I believe that that criteria has to do with the set of statutes that govern the relationship between an employer and their employees. Defines what under what circumstances somebody would need to be operating in order to be eligible to be an independent contractor. For instance, the relationship between independent contractors and other contractors versus the employer-employee relationship. They would have to be in compliance with under this. They'd have to be in compliance with the existing laws around those relationships.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, in this scenario, some contractor, let's say they're doing the grass seeding afterwards, and have subcontracted to another entity, and they later somebody finds out or thinks that they should have rather been an employee of that party instead of a subcontractor. Is that what you're referring to?
That type Makarios.
Of, that's what you're referring to, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes, if it's determined by, in this case, probably the Department of Labor and Industry, that a contractor is not complying with the laws governing the use of independent contractors, then the contractor that is in violation of those laws would not be eligible to work on taxpayer-funded projects.
Senator Westrom.
And, Mr. Chair, would that be for 3 years, or how long would this person not be eligible?
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, that's correct. For a three-year period, if they are in violation of this of these laws, then this bill would say that for 3 years they would not be eligible to work for the taxpayers.
Under that same section, Mr. Chair, if they're just a second here, a violation occurs when a contractor or vendor is statutorily required to pay $10,000 in penalties or a payroll. Is that after there's been an allegation of an of a violation and it's been settled, or I had a constituent this fall, excuse me, that had a notice of violation in a matter, and I'm not sure if the Department of Labor sends out any violations less than $10,000, even if they're wearing cloth gloves and they're supposed to have leather gloves. I mean, I'll use that as an example. My point is most of their penalties seem to have a pretty high fining authority, and of course, a lot of times on less offenses, they negotiate them down, and in some cases it's less than $10,000, but that's not a very high threshold, or what? When does that threshold get met, and how many are over $10,000? It seems to me that they probably have a lot that are $10,000 or more.
Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom. Again, this is an area that we're having a lot of discussions with contractors to make sure we're not ruling out contractors that are making minor errors in terms of properly paying their employees. I would tell you, and I don't know if the department is here, they certainly would have the data better than I would, that I think the majority of wage violations are far below $10,000, and that there, frankly, are not that many that go over $10,000. I think in the last committee, somebody from the department said there were somewhere in the range of 35 to 40 in the last 5 years that were over the $10,000 mark.
So,
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, are you aware of that? And the way it reads to me, it would be the wages they are owed plus the penalty if the total is $10,000 or more. If there's any sort of amount in dispute, that seems to be a pretty low threshold, and the company is going to be out of contracting for 3 years if they have a minor violation and They either concede to just settle something, which a lot of companies tell me they do. They just get the best deal and move on because you can't fight City Hall. And so they'd have this penalty on their books. But the cost would be 3 years of business. Is that right, Senator Saxon?
Senator Saxon.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, you know, I would think that's fairly objective. I think that it's fairly well laid out in this bill, and but you're correct. It's $10,000. It's 3 years. So,
mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I'd like to make a motion to table this bill until we have the supposed agreed language. I think I've heard three times in the last 25 minutes that that there's other language, and I'm not sure we should be voting on a bill that isn't in its final form at this point, admittedly by the author.
All right. We will definitely entertain your motion. Could we hear from the other folks who are here to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chairman,
before
that motion is not debatable.
Right. I'm not debating it. I'm asking if we can pause and hear from other.
It's not against the rules.
I'm not debating the motion itself.
The motion is not debatable.
Yeah, Mr.
He's
Chair,
we need to vote on it, and if we want to hear debate, we need to vote no. But we need to vote on it right now.
Senator Arrest, I'm asking if we can hear from the other witnesses before we table the bill.
It's against the rules.
It's not debating. It's a request.
The motion is not debatable. I'm questioning on this.
And Arrest, I'm not debating the motion.
She's been here long enough.
So, Senator Peterson, would you like to vote on the motion
right
now?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, our committee time is valuable, as Senator Bach expressed very eloquently on the floor this morning, and I'd prefer to have a vote to table this for right now and hear the other bills.
We'll take the vote. All in favor of tabling Senate File 1919, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
A division.
All in favor, please raise your hand. Okay. All opposed, please raise your hand. I'm sorry. They're being.
I'll do it again.
Can the noes please raise your hands again? There being five in favor and seven opposed, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
All right. Further questions, members, from for Senator Saxhog or the witnesses? All right, Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog or Mr. Makarios, you know, right now, I guess I just read right now, currently there's 19 general contractors that are barred from doing work on state projects right now for willful or repeated violations. So how is this bill different, or how is this bill different, or how would the Department of Labor operate differently right now if they are already, the department's already debarring contractors for some of the things you've described?
Mr. Chair, I would
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we are not trying to change the way the Department of Labor and Industry investigates, regulates, or prosecutes violators of the law. What we are trying to do is say, as the taxpayers decide what kind of contractors we're going to hire to build our public funds, that we are going to set some minimum criteria in place and say that we should not be hiring contractors that violate the law. So we're not setting up, we are not creating any bureaucracy here. We are not adding staff to any public agencies. We're not hiring investigators. What we are simply saying is the taxpayers should be able to set some criteria about what kind of contractors we hire, and that if contractors violate our laws, we don't think they should be working for us.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah. So on Senator Westrom's line of questions for you, what I understood that to mean is that right now if a contractor voluntarily pays, say, a prevailing wage violation, they do the paperwork wrong, the department shows them that they voluntarily pay that fine and that difference. If they do that three times, the department could debar them from working on state projects based on this law. When they voluntarily admit, thank you for your help, we appreciate your consultation, here's the wages that we should have paid, intended to pay, but we made a mistake in our paperwork, they would end up getting debarred after three voluntary payment violations, or potentially could.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, this bill is silent on the Department of Labor's debarment process. What we're saying is that if a contractor in this scenario has repeatedly violated the prevailing wage and has failed to pay their workers over $10,000 in a three-year period, then the taxpayers should not be hiring a contractor that makes those kinds of mistakes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, then I would have a verbal, I'd have a verbal amendment. Members, on line point, page 3, line point 3.9, where it says, based on Mr. Makarios's testimony there, that there's not their intention to debar anybody that's voluntarily paying their fines after a mistake, I would want to delete the word fails on line 3.9 and then insert has willfully or repeatedly failed. And then on line point 3.19, page 3.19, again, delete the word fails and insert the same language, has willfully or repeatedly failed. And in my view, that would, I think that would cover the intent of Mr. Makarios' testimony there, in my view.
Okay. Do members understand the motion? All right, Senator Saxog to the motion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Peterson. Based on what I know about this bill, based on what I've talked to with Mr. Makarios, and I'll let him make his own comments on this, I would not favor this amendment.
I'm sorry, not?
Not.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Peterson. I think, like I said, we're definitely in discussions about this question. I am concerned that a standard that uses willful and repeated involves investigations and staff to do that, and we are trying to do this very deliberately in a way that does not add to the to any agency. It does not add staff, does not add investigatory authority or power. That what we're trying to do is set some minimum criteria in place that a contractor has to certify that they meet. And so setting up a new kind of judicial and determinations process to determine the will of an employer is not is specifically what we're trying to avoid with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And it's important to know we have not heard from any of those employers yet, but I think we will. But members, if you vote against this amendment, you could very well have a constituent voluntarily, willfully pay a prevailing wage fine, a DBE fine. They could voluntarily do that. They could admit their guilt and do it and still be barred from bidding on state jobs if you vote against this amendment. Roll call, please.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, at this point, we have no fiscal note. You know, there's no fiscal impact with the bills that stands now. And I think Mr. Makarios voices one of the fears that we have is that you can continue to put more and more potential in for staff time, and you will start costing money. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to do this in the least expensive way possible. I think it's an effective bill.
All right.
So I would urge a vote against it.
All right. Thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a concern that it would be a strict liability, if you will, to, you know, not be able to present any evidence that you tried to meet the law and maybe you missed a day. I don't know. I just think it's it's a $10,000 penalty. It's pretty substantial. I guess maybe not in the contracting world, but it reads to me it's potentially being strict liability. So while I understand the concerns of using this specific language, I would encourage you to look into that and see if you can find peace in the valley.
All right. I did have a question. I'm sorry. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxhog, part of my concerns here has to do with a constituent situation who recently went through substantial challenges on some of the aspects of his business at great expense and labor on the part of him and his business to ultimately be completely found, yep, you were right, there were no violations whatsoever, without real provocation or anything. And I am troubled that there is no opportunity for somebody to clear themselves. You know, that, I mean, I understand what you're saying. We want to not impose costs on agencies, and yet when we put contractors and business people through some of these hoops, we're imposing costs on them. And here they don't necessarily even have an opportunity to exonerate themselves. So that's where my concern comes from on this.
Anything further on the amendments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, again, I just encourage members to support the amendment. Again, the scenario that very likely will happen, unless you're willing to trust the Enforcement Department, that the Department of Labor, you will have constituents that will voluntarily, repeatedly pay fines, and whether they could be any multitude of things, and then be debarred and banned from working on state projects. After admitting their guilt, paying their fine, and moving forward. The state agency, the Department of Labor, ought to be training contractors and consulting contractors on how to do it right. They ought to not be issuing fines and penalties on their first time out.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I would urge members to seriously consider supporting this amendment. Just to clarify, Senator Saxhog, this is penalties and unpaid wages. So if they've been found to not paid a correct prevailing wage, for example, let's just say $5 or $10 an hour, it doesn't take many hours to total up to $5,000 or $10,000. But that's plus the penalties in the prior 3 years, as it's written right here in the summary. Members understand this is a very low threshold. It's the prior 3 years. It's wages and penalties, and I know constituents. There just isn't any penalties that come out of the Department of Labor out of the chute very often under $10,000, and to settle them under minimum ones are going to be $1,000 to $2,000 or $3,000 on the bottom end for your small contractors, very, very small contractors or business owners, probably sole practitioners, a few employees maybe. It doesn't take long to get up to a $10,000 penalty as a compromise. And, I mean, ultimately we want the department and the entities working together, and if there's ways they can train them to do this. And a lot of times that's part of a stipulation agreement. They say, hey, I'm sorry we made a mistake. Come and help us do better. We'll agree to a penalty here, department. And these companies are scrutinized very hard. I would guess most legislators in the House and Senate would have trouble complying at times, or figuring it all out and making sure there's absolutely nothing wrong. And I've got a situation right now where 2 years ago a bureaucrat came out, not from the Department of Labor, but it's an example. A different agency signed off everything on this entity. 2 years now later, same department, different inspector comes out, and all of a sudden there's all these problems that they were never even given a chance of due process to follow through. My point is, even among the agency and people enforcing, one can sign off completely as everything's fine. The next one can come out, and if they have a bad day or look at something differently, they'll they'll cite the entity with all kinds of problems, and so hence they call their legislators, both the representative and their senator, and we're dealing with this and have spent hours and hours and days of our time now dealing with it, because 2 years later, the same agency, different inspector, nothing's changed in the makeup of the property that they're citing, and it's an airport. And the next inspector finds it wrong, and so all of a sudden they're in a scenario where they've got to work things through. And so think about this. These are hardworking men and women, families and businesses, and I don't know, I mean, you debar everybody and all of a sudden we won't have roads and bridges built in this state, or the taxpayer will be paying a whole lot because there will be one or two entities that can do it, and or are left, and I just think this is a reasonable amendment, and so I would urge us to try to bring some balance here that that a lot of these businesses are willing to try to work something out with the department and improve. And so this language in the bill currently collects all that together, and that's the small, a low threshold. It's not just the penalty, it's the wages that, or whatever it would be that that makes that violation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd just restate what I said at the beginning of my remarks. While the vast majority of construction contractors follow the rules, those who skirt the law in order to win bids cost taxpayers money, and they gain an unfair advantage over the contractors who are doing things the right way. And I think that that's what this bill is about. We'll try to work with the exceptions. Mr. Makarios has a couple of comments before the vote, too, please. Thank you.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll be very brief. Senator Westrom, I want to point out, and I don't know if somebody from the department is here to talk about the specific process, but the vast majority of prevailing wage violations did not have penalties in addition to the wages. In general, the department encourages contractors to pay their workers what are owed, and then moves forward. So in the vast majority of cases, there are not penalties stacked on top of the wages owed. So the $10,000 would be the wages owed in most cases to the employees. Number two, I agree with what Senator Peterson is saying. I think the intent of his is that what we're not doing is hiring investigators to go out and crack down on contractors. What we're trying to do here is provide some incentives for contractors to play by the rules so that unscrupulous contractors, when taking a look at this and looking at a sworn statement about whether or not they can sign a sworn statement that they abide by these laws, are going to think twice about submitting a bid for a public project paid for by the taxpayers. And what we're trying to do here is create a deterrent effect to people cheating on taxpayer-funded projects by saying that if you do cheat on a taxpayer-funded project and you're found to have committed that violation, you're not a responsible contractor, and we're not going to hire you back again. And so I think rather than hire a bunch of investigators, there are more than one way to crack this nut. One would be to hire a bunch of investigators to train employers and to crack down on people who are cheating. Another one is to say, if we catch you, we're not going to hire you again. And so that's the approach we're taking with this bill. It's a minimal one. My third and final point, Mr. Chair, I hear the concerns raised by Senator Kent, Senator Franzen. These are very good concerns. And at some point, I'm going to move back there, and you're going to hear from some employers who I hope will testify that we're working with them to make sure we can thread this needle where we're not keeping contractors who make minor or inadvertent mistakes off of public projects, but what we're really trying to do here is make sure that the people who are repeatedly violating the law, people that are committing major violations on one working for a school district, do not end up working for Minsky on the next project, or not working for the county on the next project. That if you cheat one unit of government, we're not going to hire you back for any more taxpayer projects.
Anything further on the amendment, members? Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if we aren't a little premature on the amendment in that we haven't heard anything from the two people that are listed here as having contractors behind their name. I don't think I can vote for it or against it until I hear what they say. So I'd urge, Mr. Chair, that we move along. We take care of this amendment and then move along.
Okay. All right. Are we ready to vote? Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted. Clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
No.
Senator Champion?
No.
Senator Franzen?
No.
Senator Jensen?
Yes.
Senator Kent?
Yes.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Senator Miller? Senator Osmick?
Yes.
Senator Peterson?
Yes.
Senator Pratt? Senator Reinert?
Yes.
Senator Rest? No. Senator Senjum?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni? Senator Westrum? Yes. Senator Weaker?
Yes.
There being 10 yeses and 4 noes, the amendment is adopted. All right. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Champion offers the A2, which has been typed up and is being distributed.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Champion.
The A2 amendment seeks to add as a part of one's consideration as to whether someone should receive a contract if a contractor has met or has failed to meet established disadvantaged business goals due to a lack of good faith effort. Now, I put that in there because there are some extenuating circumstances where someone fails to meet goals, but if they've made good faith efforts, then it would be acceptable. So I think this would be appropriate. It's usually a part of the articulated part of the contract, and so I just think it would be appropriate. And so I'm asking for support.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, I think you got a great amendment here. I was hoping that you might accept a friendly verbal amendment to that. It said after the word enterprise goals, if we would insert or prevailing wage due to lack of a good faith effort, is that something you'd consider?
Senator
Mr.
Champion.
Chair, the only reason why I would not consider that just because it's a different sort of notion, right? Prevailing wage is different from established goals and then using their good faith efforts around the goals. I think if you add in the prevailing wage, it takes away from the idea that I'm putting forward, which is something that contractors are to react to.
Senator Peterson, a good faith effort is a specific activity that has a metric attached to it. It's a very specific, measurable activity. I don't know how you would measure good faith efforts on prevailing wages. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, Senator Champion, there's a DBE company right now that's in a lawsuit with the Department of Transportation over prevailing wage, who they believe, of course, the contractors believe they've made a good faith effort to follow the law. The Department of Transportation disagrees, so they've been forced to sue the state of Minnesota. It's a DBE company that's involved in the prevailing wage dispute. I think it would be appropriate, and I think offer further protection to DBE organizations.
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Champion.
Again, you know, I think that the issue that you raise, Senator Peterson, is an important one, and I'm not by any means diminishing the importance of that person's issue, and I would hope that they would be able to prevail. Here, I'm just talking about the idea as pertains to adding in the prevailing wage would just change the dynamic of this particular idea and entity, well, this notion, because it is about, you know, goals and whether they met those goals and whether they can have demonstrated that they've done everything within good faith in order to meet those goals. Yeah. And sometimes they make a good faith effort and fail to meet the goals. I understand that. But that's the only reason why I just don't see that as a friendly amendment here, although I support the idea.
All right. I understand your position. Thanks.
All right. Senator Saxhawk, to the amendment.
Well, I'm still trying to decide if I understand it. And so, and maybe Mr. Makarios understands it and could respond better than I could.
All right. Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, as somebody who spends a fair amount of time and energy working with employers to meet specifically workforce goals, not necessarily DBE goals, but workforce goals, and spend a lot of time on this issue, related issue, here's what I'll say about the crafting of this bill and what concerns me about your amendment. Is we spent significant time before session, leading up to session, working with the Department of Transportation, the Department of Labor and Industry, the Department of Administration, with cities and counties, coming up with the criteria that are in this bill and figuring out specific measurable ways and what would constitute a violation and what their process are for going through these violations. So I'm not sure what the process for either the DOT or the Department of Human Rights is for determining that a contractor has not had a lack, has had a lack of good faith effort. So what, the only thing that concerns me about your amendment is opening a new can of worms that would be hard to measure. And I fear that we would muddy up what feels like we're pretty close to a deal with a lot of contractor associations on our minimum criteria. This adds a very significant new minimum criteria, and I'm worried that it's a muddy area that I don't have the particular details figured out on. Not that that's undoable, but it makes it more complicated.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
To the testifier, I appreciate your words, and I appreciate you attempting to articulate a way to get around this particular amendment. But when we think in terms of good faith efforts, that's something that is not only a term of art, but it's something that is established in the industry. And there is a measurable way by which to look at it, and there's a process that is taken in order to even come up with the goals and to determine if someone has made truly good faith efforts. So with that being said, we are not complicating the matter. In fact, we're saying that as a part of the requirement that is usually done in these various entities, that they are established goals and that a prime should attempt to meet those goals, because that's a part of the contract itself. And if they're unable to meet the goals, then they have to demonstrate to the compliance department why they did not meet them. And so it's not complicated, it's very simple, but it's something that needs to be done and should be done, and it's already a part of the process. So I would ask the committee to support my amendment.
All right. Anything further, members, on the amendment? On the A2, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
A motion carries. All right. Moving on. Anything further, members, for the witnesses or Senator Saxog, before we take additional testimony? All right. Why don't we call up folks who are on the testifiers list? Mr. Werke from the AGC and Mr. Raines from the ABC. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota, construction trade association made up primarily of union contractors. I say that for the purposes of this discussion, for background, because as employers, we maintain the relationship with the principally with the union workforce. The bill in front of you, as it was written, the concerns and the robust discussion that's occurred here in the committee, I think, has covered a lot of the initial concerns that we've had in discussions with our partners in the building trades. I'm here today to tell you, and maybe more so, give you a progress report than to comment specifically on what's in the bill per se. We've had significant discussions with the building trades back on last Friday, and we have offered to them some changes from our perspective that we think helps this bill significantly. I'm willing to tell you at this point that we think we have some agreements in principle as to how the bill will be changed and can be changed to make it a product that we eventually will be able to say that we no longer stand in the way of its progress. So I don't want to go, unless the committee has questions, any specifics of what those are. It's kind of addressing areas that are in the bill that you've already covered or some other areas. So I think with that, I'd be better served by standing for questions.
Great. Questions, members? So, Mr. Werke. Under Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Werke, I was reading something here. If you maybe addressed it. So I'm not sure, is the AGC in support of this bill or are they opposed to this bill?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, it's a work in progress. We are continuing to have productive discussions with the proponents of the bill, including the authors and the trades. And we think that we have some agreements in principle on some of those major areas of concern that's already been discussed, the penalties, the thresholds of where the accountability measures stand, the affordability of due process rights if you've been found in violation, those types of concerns.
So, Mr. Chair, so Mr. Werke, so we don't have an amendment here now, so I'm not sure what that means. Have we just had not time to draft an amendment, or do you need to have the board vote on it, or what's happening here?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Peterson, no. From our association standpoint, we feel we're making progress towards a product that we will be able to say is a workable product that will have merit in terms of the construction marketplace. It's our goal, as is the author's goal, to have a competitive level playing field where the folks that abide by the rules are treated and have the same opportunity as those that are skirting the rules in terms of the ability to win projects and economic opportunity. And I think as we work through this, we will get to that point. But unfortunately, some of the things I think that are in front of you today, we're not able to reflect that. But I just am here to tell you we feel confident we're making progress.
Senator Peterson.
So, Mr. Werke, representing the general contractors, do you have an opinion? Is this bill going to help create more bidders for state jobs, or is it going to create less bidders for state jobs?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer the question. I'm not sure how you can answer that.
Okay.
I think we want our members would like to see everyone who is bidding the work have to comply with the laws and standards that are ascribed by the state in the same manner and fashion. Those that are not able to do that and continue to win work take that opportunity away from what I believe our members do in following the spirit and letter of the law.
Thank you.
Further questions, members?
Right.
Forgive me, I was just handed a gavel.
Madam Chair.
Senator Westrom.
How many other witnesses do we have? Just questions, but I'm happy to let the witnesses all talk.
Senator, we have one more scheduled at this point, and I see another hand in the back of the room.
Okay. Madam Chair. Very good. Madam Chair. Okay. There's two.
Senator Peters. Oh, do we have two more?
Two more.
And me.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a question?
Not for now. I'd rather let the testifiers go first.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Raines?
Good afternoon, Chair and Senators. My name is Phil Raines. I'm with Associated Builders and Contractors. Much like Mr. Werke, he represents AGC, which is General Contractors, that has a significant amount of members with union contracts. ABC is kind of the flip side of that. The majority of our members, both general contractors and subcontractors, are merit shops. Though we do have some members that have union contracts. We have in the past testified on this bill with significant concerns, many of which have been addressed by the senators before here. We have concerns about people that are willfully going out and trying to comply with the law, sometimes get tripped up over calculations, sometimes get tripped up over simple matters such as when you're installing sheet metal on the side of a building and you classify your people as carpenters, which is very common, and some people come in and tell you, no, you've misclassified them. They should be sheet metal workers that are doing that. That's an actual example that's happened out there, and it can add up to significant amounts of dollars. I think the committee has taken great strides here in adopting Senator Peterson's amendment in going to the state standard that's out there already on for willful and repeated violations. Those people that aren't being tripped up, the people that are going out and trying, attempting to skirt the law, are vulnerable under that standard, and we are very encouraging of that. We have to deal with bad bidders out there, just like everybody else, and we're not we're happy to see those people debarred when you're trying to skirt the law. Again, we're very thankful for the committee adopting that amendment. We want to make sure the bill goes to the people that are actually causing problems, not to the people that are going out and trying to build a building and sometimes get tripped up by the intricacies of the law.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what we're talking about here is basically you think that it's a pretty good bill as amended.
As amended certainly moves it in the right direction from what I'm sorry.
Mr. Rand.
Put it through the chair. Chair and Senator Sachs, sorry. I think this definitely moves the bill in the right direction, and I appreciate that very much. I have heard third hand various things that are in the agreement that are being negotiated between the AGC and the various building trades. I would like to take a more active role in bringing more information to the table to help this bill be perfected, because there are a lot of traps that need to be fixed. And from what I have heard of it, some of the improvements coming from that bill would also be good. But I think the amendment that went on today is a very significant one that needs to be incorporated.
All right, Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Raines, I'll ask you the same question I did of Mr. Werke. Do you think this bill will create more bidders on state projects, or will it create less bidders?
Mr. Raines.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I believe that in the end it probably will lead to less people bidding in its current form. I'm hopeful that it can be fixed in a way that will give people more confidence to do it without increasing their liability for the good people out there.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further, members, for these testifiers? We have a couple more who have requested to speak.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. So Mike Goman from the Builders Association and Gary Thaden with the National Electrical Contractors. Please come forward. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Mike Goman. I'm the president and owner of W. Goman Construction Company. We're a small commercial general contracting firm in St. Cloud area, in St. Joseph, just outside of St. Cloud. And we do about 50% of our work as government bidding at various municipal levels, and some work for MinSCU. And then the rest is private work that we do. And, you know, as a contractor, I read through this and looked at it as to how I would have to implement this through the bidding process. And, you know, on a regular bid day for a hard bid project or even a best value project, we will receive, you know, for a $2 to $3 million project, we will receive 200 to 300 bids that day in, you know, fax format or email format that we have to read and decipher to make sure that, you know, the contractors are qualified, you know, from what they're picking up for bid sections, they have sales tax included, that, you know, if they meet any target group requirements or anything else. And as we're going through those, trying to decide who we should use in each section for a contractor, for me, at the end of the day, I have to turn around and sign an affidavit that says all of these contractors and their subcontractors and vendors below them have paid all of their taxes and work comp issues, any prevailing wage issues, and everything else. There is not time. And we're getting bids literally up to the minute before we call a bid in. I have somebody sitting at the site where the bid is due on a cell phone that we read numbers off to, and very often they're dropping that bid off with less than a minute or two in order to do that. So I read through this and look at it, and what I will do as a contractor in the unintended consequences is I will choose contractors I have a relationship with that I've worked with in the past that I know, you know, are good quality, you know, standing contractors. And what that's going to do ultimately is really hurt the upstart companies. You know, we do our good faith efforts and work really hard to get the target groups and the disadvantaged, you know, businesses to, you know, to bid on projects and work with us. But, you know, those are the people that are just starting out in business that, you know, might be behind in a payment on something for unemployment tax or something else. And, you know, they're going to show up on lists, or, you know, if I don't know who they are and that they're in really good standing, I'm going to take, you know, once I hit my target group number, I'm going to take the next contractor that I know. I mean, this bill basically is driving construction away from where the target group goals are going and trying to accomplish, and driving it back to a good old boys network where I work with a contractor that I know. And I don't want to compete against people who are not paying their taxes and complying with government requirements any more than anybody else does. But this is going to make it where I will choose contractors that are $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 more because I know they're in good standing versus somebody I don't know who it is that I just got a bid from who may be a very good contractor, but I just don't have a relationship. Because if I put the contractor down and then, in, you know, in the next 2 weeks after the bid, I'm working with them to get all of their information and verify who they are as a contractor. If they haven't, you know, paid their taxes on something, then I'm going to turn around and have to use the next contractor up, which that money then comes out of my, you know, overhead and profit number, which is, I mean, we bid these on very small margins already. And so, I mean, this will just drive the cost of public construction work up, and it will definitely limit the number of contractors, because I have to look at it at the end of the day, is it worth me signing for people I don't know three, four, five tiers down that, you know, they may, you know, there's too much risk down the line. I have to protect myself as a business person and as a contractor, and I would urge you to vote against this bill. So.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator
Mr.
Peterson.
Chair, Mr. Goldman, thanks for coming down, and to the committee members, I know Mr. Goldman we work in the same community, lives in my district, but did not know he's going to be here till today. But I just had a question for you that I don't know. Are you members of either the ABC or the AGC that just testified?
Mr. Goldman.
I am not. I have been in the past. Years ago, I was a member of the AGC. To be perfectly honest, there's some politics within both of those organizations that I don't necessarily agree with. We're an open shop contractor, but I work with union contractors and non-union contractors every day. And I don't want to deal with the politics of that in those associations. I want to build buildings. I want to put my employees to work. And, you know, so I am a member of the Builders Association of Minnesota because we do a little bit of residential construction. But I'm not of either of those other two groups.
Thank you.
All right. Questions, members? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an interesting point, or a valid point we ought to consider. Who's all at the table negotiating this bill? There's a lot of contractors that may not be part of any of these groups that are just busy building and working and trying to make a living. And so that's the people we need to represent as well, not just the ones that can be part of a group that make this deal. And I think the ones that are less likely to be a part of the group might be the ones that are even more affected negatively than even the ones making the deal.
Thank you. Mr. Thaden.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association and also the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. So I represent subcontractors who do plumbing, heating, air conditioning, and electrical work. We are in support of this bill. In principle, we believe that this is going in the right direction. This, to answer Senator Peterson's question before he asks it, I believe that we will have better bidders on our government projects because of this bill. We do have some issues that we're talking to the author with and the building trades in regards to the $10,000 amount. We would like that to be higher, and we're working on language to do that. We're also talking to them about the due process issue, especially with local units of government and how that would affect contractors. But we think that this is a good bill, and it's going in the right direction. Thank you.
Questions, members? All right, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I think he hit on one of my questions earlier. What number do you think it should be? 10,000 you indicated you thought was too low.
Mr. Chair, I have talked to a number of people, and we have pegged the number that we're talking to them about of 25,000.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thaden, just to pin you down a little more specifically on Senator Peterson's questions, are you saying that you would support this bill in its current form?
Mr. Thaden.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in its current form, I believe that the $10,000 amount is too low, and I think there's some due process issues that we still need to resolve.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
All right, so members, anything further?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, and I'd ask Council for an oral amendment to raise the $10,000 to $25,000. That might be a good start. I had maybe a higher number in mind, but I think if it's going to move out of here, I think we at least have a fiduciary obligation to try to make the bill as good as we can, given what we've been told and what we've raised as concerns. So.
Right.
I'll move that motion at some point, Mr. Chair.
All right. Now would be a good time because I think we need to move on to our other bills very soon.
I'd move that if Council could just
all right.
State it.
Ms. Berezovsky, can you help us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just wanna, for a moment. On line 3.9 and on line 3.20, delete 10,000 and insert 25,000.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxhog.
I have no objection to the amendment.
All right. Very good. Members understand the Westrom motion. Senator?
No.
Okay. All right. All in favor of the Westrom amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since oral amendments are the soup of the day, and Ms. Berezovsky, I did kind of look for you, but you were busy, so I'll have to do it this way. On line 3.13, having heard some of the discussion, my concern here is that inadvertent errors in good faith that just gobble up things and throw sand in the works unintentionally. So my thought was that on line 3.13 to add a sentence that says, this does not apply to corrected miscalculations or misclassifications.
I'm sorry, Senator Kiffmeyer, can you repeat that, Senator Kiffmeyer?
This does not apply to corrected miscalculations or misclassifications. It could be phrased differently. It could be errors in calculations or errors in classifications. The idea is that miscalculation or it's common that clerical errors are not counted against people. They're corrected, they're dealt with, but not counted in the same manner as others might be. So that's my goal in language that I'm trying to get at. Ms. Berezovsky has something better. I welcome that.
All right. So Ms. Berezovsky was going to give it some thought if she has advice, but in the meantime, we'll ask Senator Saxhog to respond and Mr. Makarios to respond to the Kiffmeyer's suggestion. This does not apply to corrected misclassifications or miscalculations. Did I get that right?
Was the,
Senator Sackton.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I'd probably want to look at the commas or the semicolons because miscalculated the first one probably should be miscalculated the second one, too, because you're saying miscalculated blank or.
That's why we need Ms. Bereshofsky to help us.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I guess where I'm having trouble is somebody would have to determine that there was a miscalculation or a misclassification. So it seems like it's another way of stating what Senator Peterson had suggested before about characterizing it as a willful violation, with the same problem of somebody has to make that determination as to what's willful or what's a miscalculation. So I think the words express your intent, but I think it's another way of stating a willful violation, which maybe is easier to understand. I don't know.
Well,
that's my advice.
Senator
Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I really think that this gets down to kind of the nitty-gritty of what we're talking about here. I realize that a miscalculation is a miscalculation and can be dealt with as such, but that determination, and particularly in a large, $25,000 miscalculation, I don't care, is something that we're really trying to deal with in this bill. So what we're basically saying on that stuff is that there's no guilt at all in. It's determined that they're found out, kind of. That's
all right.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I think even the IRS gives you the benefit of the doubt in regards to a calculation. So certainly I think we can do that as well here.
Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Peterson. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I was going to add in response to Senator Saxog, in regards to the DBE contractor I referred to before, within a MnDOT internal audit, there's $1 million miscalculation in net worth, which is related specifically to somebody's ability to do business as a DBE. Senator Kiffmeyer's request is not unreasonable in terms of an errors and omissions exemption in terms of this bill, because clearly there's examples of far, far greater and far greater costly mistakes that are simple calculation issues rather than, in this case, relating to $25,000. I think we need to find a spot to cover that somehow.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I believe it's a subjective judgment, and I don't agree with the senator's amendment.
I actually agree with Senator Kiffmeyer's intent. I think we accomplished that with the Peterson amendment, which was adopted. So I think we're just kind of restating what we've already done in that amendment. Anything further on the amendment? All in favor of the Kiffmeyer amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No. No.
Division.
Motion prevails. The amendment is not.
Thank you.
Sorry to pause.
All right. Anything further, members?
One question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Either you, Senator Saxog, or the testifier. I think the other testifier brought up a very interesting point, which was, he asked, or at least there was some, it was implied, who else is at the table negotiating this bill? When you earlier, Mr. Kyle McCarlis? When you testified earlier, you talked about over the summer and for a long time, there's been a lot of negotiation. So can you tell the committee who was all a part of that negotiation?
Senator Saxog or Mr. Makarios?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Champion, I want to be clear. We're not going back to the summer. We're going back to the beginning of this year.
Okay.
We have been in discussions with many state agencies, including...
Can you identify them, please?
Including the Department of Human Rights, Department of Administration, Department of Transportation, the Department of Labor and Industry. We have talked with cities, counties, and other organizations representing public entities, which I would probably screw up if I tried to name them. And then we have talked with a number of contractor associations, including the Associated General Contractors, numerous subcontractor associations, some of
such
whom,
as?
Such as the mechanical contractors and the electrical contractors that Mr. Thaden represents, including the Drywall and Plaster Association, the Floor Covering Association, the Sheet Metal and Air and Roofing Contractors Association, I would say, are the contractors that have given the most input into the bill in front of us today.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. So have you had any discussion with the Association of Women Contractors, the National Association of Minority Contractors? Any of those groups been a part of this discussion?
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, frankly, they have not been at the table, although we have reached out to those organizations. I have not directly spoken with the women contractors, but part of our association has reached out to them, had a discussion. I have a call in to the minority contractors right now, which we have not successfully connected, but we certainly have reached out.
Okay, thank you. All right, members, anything further? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say just that Senator Saxon, completely support 100% what the intent and the spirit of this bill is. You know, the purpose is necessary, and it's a great idea. My concern is that it is in its current form, it still catches throws too wide a net and catches good, well-meaning businesses. I think, you know, the unintended consequences have been spelled out. I think it probably might disproportionately hurt smaller businesses than larger ones. My concern is I'm hearing great ideas about what this next amendment's going to look like, but we have to vote on the bill that's in front of us right now, and that is my concern, that the burden of proof is going to fall to businesses who are trying to act in good faith when we all support trying to take care of the ones who have acted in bad faith, and that becomes too much of a burden on those businesses.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Senator Kent, you know, this bill came in one way, and it's got three rather significant amendments on it. That doesn't take care of any of your problems?
Senator Kent.
If you like the bill, and it's...
Mr. Chair, and Senator Saxhog, one of the things that I've heard expressed by some of the contractors' organizations is the part of the amendments that are being discussed that would address due process, and I don't think we've really gotten into that issue here. I mean, I know we've looked at some of the thresholds, but the due process part I think is still unclear at this stage, and so that is where my concerns primarily lie.
All right, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Saxon. There's something that concerns me here that was brought up by Mr. Goman. And that's Clause 8, line 334, where it talks about all subcontractors or vendors of whatever tier the contractor intends to use, that they also have to sign this agreement under oath. And now the nearest I have understood is that this oath cascades downward. So that oath has to be signed by their contractors and their vendors, and so eventually it goes down to the smallest vendor and the smallest contractor, and that the general has to be responsible for it, and so do all of their tiers, or the general has to be responsible for all the tiers downward and has to get this oath signed. Is that your intent, to have everyone that's in at every level sign an oath, and that the general has to gather that all right down to the smallest vendor?
Well,
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I really don't think that you'd want the general contractor to take on that liability. He needs to have each one of those contractors to verify this. I mean, that's what we, Mr. Raines, that's you know, that's the thing that wasn't completely clear in his testimony, I didn't think, is the fact that the smaller contractors need to sign these, and of course, the general contractor needs to verify his the things that he does, but he isn't he if he gets this signed from the subcontractors, then they're responsible, and he needs to collect them all and send them in.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxlog, so does that mean that the general takes the liability of conforming to this, or is the subcontractor the one that cannot be part of the next bid or has, is subjected to the screening from next time?
I'll give that to Senator Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, the intent here is for each contractor to certify that they are following the laws of the state of Minnesota that are specified in the bill, and so that the general contractor would specify that they follow the law, and they would require their subcontractors to verify that they follow the law, and so on, so that every contractor on a construction job would verify that they're following the laws.
So then this would have to be changed.
Mr. Chairman?
But let me say, Senator, that a general contractor is not liable for the performance of a subcontractor. If a subcontractor is not following the law, that liability does not flow uphill to the general contractor. They simply have to verify that they have sworn that they follow the law.
Hey, Mr. Chair, and are we assuming that that signed affidavit is for more than one contract, or is that a certification of the contractor, or is it just related to one job?
Senator Dibble, Senator Carlson, a contractor, when they for the job, they will verify that they're in compliance with the laws that are the minimum criteria that are stated there. So it'll be a per job.
All right. Yeah. Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, has the bill been moved yet?
It has not.
Can I move the bill?
Sure.
Does it need to be referred to
jobs?
Okay. Agriculture and rural development?
Yes.
Okay. I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Okay, so Senator Tomasoni moves Senate File 1919 as amended, recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Jobs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, do you have a question?
Well, I did, but we're in the process of a vote or a superior motion?
No. You can use it as a call for the vote. Please proceed,
okay.
Senator Kiffmeyer's motion.
Well, line 4.8, it seems to contradict that. I'm not quite sure. It says failure to verify compliance with any one of the minimum criteria will render them ineligible to be awarded a contract. So, you know, what I see the one sentence, shall not be held liable. You can rely on such a statement. Then it says failure to verify compliance with anyone will render them ineligible. So, there's an awful lot of words here. Almost every one of these paragraphs that I've read, it seems as though the farther I get down, then they start undoing even some of the sentences above that really give me great concern. I know there may be another amendment, but that's not what I'm voting on now. I'm voting on this language.
Okay. Thank you. So we have the motion in front of us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
The motion passes.
Division.
All right. All in favor, please raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. Of there being 8 yeses and 6 noes, the motion passes and the bill is referred. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. So members, it took longer than I thought. It's 20 to 5. We have 3 bills. I think Senator Kent's bill might not take long. We'll see. y'all are doing your due diligence today, though, and that's a good thing. Senator Kent.
going to file 2251, our annual renewal of the Met Council's capital bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry that we are a disappointment in talking about bonding authorization for transit. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 2251. It's a Met Council agency bill which seeks authorization to issue regional bonds for regional transit capital needs. As background, please recall that Met Council must receive legislative authorization to issue regional bonds for transit capital projects. Regional transit bonds are not state general obligation bonds. Rather, they are funded by the Met Council Transit Debt Service Levy. Regional transit bonds support the capital projects of all regional transit providers and services provided throughout the seven-county metro area, including Metro Transit, suburban transit providers, Metro Mobility, and Transit Link Dial-A-Ride. Fleet replacement represents the greatest portion of these funds, about 80%. Buses are replaced on fixed schedules aligned with FTA guidelines. Transit bonds are also used for capital preservation, park and ride lot expansions and improvements. I imagine there are some potholes this year that will need some attention. And other capital equipment that help the regional transit programs operate efficiently. This request is for $37 million in 2014 and $38.3 million in 2015 for a total of $75.3 million of new bonding authority across the 2 years. The bonding authorization has historically been included in the public finance article of the omnibus tax bill, but has also been included a few times in the omnibus transportation finance bill. Here with me today is Judge Shetnan, the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, who will provide more information about this request and answer questions.
Great. Thank you, Senator Kent. Mr. Shetnan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. We appreciate Senator Kent for carrying this bill, which we bring before the committee every year. There is a little twist to this bill that I would like to add. In the past, we've come forward with a 1% increase to each previous year's authority. What we have done this year is we've actually made that adjustment for inflation. So you'll see that last year's authority we received $35.8 million, so we would have been back with $36.2 million. We did make an inflationary adjustment to bring that number to $37 million. That goes back to 2003 when we started putting forward a 1% increase. We have since found that over time that our buying ability has been reduced significantly, and so we have made that adjustment based on what we anticipate the cost of our fleet, the inflationary cost of the fleet, and then what we've also found with our shelters and just our regular transit capital needs. So that adjustment has been made, and you did a wonderful job of explaining the bill, and I do know that Mr. Clark is here representing the opt-outs who would like to comment as well, but I can speak to any other questions you may have, but I think Senator Kent did a great job.
Great. Mr. Clark. Do you have Clark bars for everyone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I did not bring Clark bars.
I don't know if we're going to let you talk.
Next time.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Clark. Senator Sendrum wanted to ask a question.
Mr. Chair, and to either the witnesses, there was mention about potholes. This money does not go to repair roads, does it?
I think the reference is because the buses have been driving over lots of potholes and been taking a beating. It does not. Yeah, it does not go to road.
Yeah,
road.
That's correct. But this is
correct. This is You're correct. Transit. Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. We're going to have a conversation about that later, about how brutal this particular winter has been on our roads, and see if we can't figure something out special. Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We would like to thank Senator Kent for bringing this initiative forward, and just to echo our strong support for this initiative. We're pleased that the Metropolitan Council has looked at a two-year authorization. It's much easier for the suburban providers to plan their capital priorities if they're given a two-year opportunity rather than the one-year authorization. Right. Again, we'd just like to say thank you to Senator Kent and strongly support this bill.
All right. Thank you. The Clark Bar reference, members, is when Mr. Clark was Representative Clark, every time he presented a bill, he sweetened us up with a Clark Bar.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I can any longer do that.
So, all right. Questions, members? Senator Kent, are we going to send this to the Tax Committee? Do you know? What do we, right. I mean,
or finance?
Mr. Chair, it did go to taxes in the House this morning. If
all right.
That helps.
All right. Yeah. Nothing would stop us from including an article in a finance bill, should we so desire to do that. So why don't we, Senator Kent, would you like to, questions, members? We're all set? Okay. Senator Kent, your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2251 be passed and referred to
taxes. All right. On the Kent motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. All right, members. Senator Carlson. Oh, here we are. Senator Carlson has two bills, Senate File 2268, which we'll hear first, and then 2270. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you've been in the committee all along. Welcome to the table. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 2268, which is an expansion of the advisory committee, the accessibility advisory committee scope. And what it does is it primarily doesn't change the committee in its makeup or its appointment, but moves it in statute to give it expanded authority over additional duties. I have with me Mr. Ron Biss, who is the chair of the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee. Give more information on this.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Biss.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to say a few words. My name is Ron Biss, and Senator Carlson said, I chair the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee, which is under the Metropolitan Council. And as my discussion goes on, I'm going to refer it to the acronym we have, TAC, versus pronouncing the whole name ongoing. It gets a tongue twister. But anyway, I have been a member of the committee for 20 years and have chaired the TAC committee for the last 7 years. When I first joined the committee, the primary focus was on issues, concerns, and various aspects of metro mobility, which is the metro area paratransit system. As time went on a little later, when metro transit was phasing in wheelchair-accessible buses into their fleet, we were able to give a fair amount of input as to how to prioritize which routes should be wheelchair accessible, because it was not a one-time changeover. It took approximately 10 years. So, and then moving on a few more years, at the advent of the Blue Line, LRT, also known as the Hiawatha Corridor, the committee had much discussion and input on accessibility revolving around the light rail vehicles and station design. And the same is true for the North Star commuter rail, the Green Line, which is we know probably as the Central Corridor. And with the Green Line, we put a lot of emphasis on pedestrian ways and streetscape. Our feeling is walkability is part of transportation, and we definitely need to address that when it comes to accessibility also. And then also, along with the just mentioned items, the committee has been involved with the discussion as it pertains to the proposed bus rapid transit lines, and in the past or currently with the Target Fields transit station and the interchange and the renovation of the Union Depot. Additionally, the committee gives input and feedback in participates in updates on the transportation policy plan and Thrive Minnesota MSP. And also, TAC has had the opportunity to be represented on some committees that MnDOTS has invited the committee to participate in. It would be things such as the Complete Street Policy Project, the Minnesota Goal Project. Another example would be the Snelling Avenue Project Stakeholders Advisory Committee, and so on. So as you notice, our activities have grown beyond that of just special transportation services. So this change in language, which Senate File 2268 is bringing forward to you, more parallels the activities of TAC. That concludes my presentation. And I'm willing to entertain
any questions. All right. Thank you, Mr. Biss. Questions, members? So members, the shorthand version is the TAC really has been functioning, you know, recently in the manner in which now we would authorize it. So the TAC had been formed solely to advise the Met Council on special transportation services, you know, transportation services specifically designed to serve the disabilities community. But they've been advising the Met Council on all the things that all the activities and planning and long range planning that Mr. Biss described, and that would just this would just conform to how it currently operates. So it's a fairly simple change. Pretty straightforward. Makes it more clear. A problem did crop up. We're going to hear about that next. Anything further, members? All right. Senator Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the testimony. Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 2268 be recommended to pass and forwarded to the committee that stand. I think that's where we go to state
and local. To the floor.
To the floor.
All right. All in favor of the Carlson motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Thank you.
Chair and
committee. Senate File 2270. All right, Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and committee, members of the committee, I have Senate File 2270. This is light rail transit, or LRT vehicles, design standards, adoption, and report requirement. What this does is it directs the Metropolitan Council to adopt light rail vehicle design standards and share those standards with the Accessibility Committee and the TAC, as we had been advised, which is the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee. There has been some dispute as to what constitutes an acceptable vehicle for the disabled community. And I have brought with me Ms. Margot M. Dickey Cross, who is the accessibility specialist from the Minnesota Council on Disability.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. So good to be here today. Mr. Chair, I have some prepared testimony. Should I give it at this time?
Yes, that would be great.
Thank you. In the May 2010 meeting minutes of the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee, the following exchange took place between a committee member and Met Council staff. Severance, who'd served on the committee for several years, asked, "The cars that are coming in, are they the same as the original cars on Hiawatha?" Met Council staff responded, "They will probably not be exactly the same just because of advancements, but they are using the same specifications. The handicapped area will basically be the same in the new cars." After receiving this assurance, you can only imagine our surprise and dismay when the new Central Corridor LRT vehicles arrived in 2013, and they were drastically different and considerably less accessible. The second generation LRT vehicles are less accessible to riders who use wheelchairs and other mobility devices such as scooters. The new vehicles fail to address our access and traveling needs and force us to separate from those who may be traveling with us and for whom we may be responsible. The first generation vehicles used on the Hiawatha LRT line provided two dedicated wheelchair seating areas that measured 36 by 48 inches in each car, two of them. This dedicated space also provided two seats for companions who we may be traveling with. The new vehicles, the second generation vehicles, eliminate both of these features. The dedicated seating for wheelchair users is gone, and so is the companion seating for individuals traveling in wheelchairs or scooters. The second generation vehicles provide in its place fold-up seats. Okay? Now, in order to use these spaces, these seats have to be unoccupied and in the flip-up position. Since there's no conductor or engineer or driver present to ask riders seated in this area to move, it has become the responsibility of the wheelchair user or my companion to clear the seats in order to use the seating areas. It's been my experience, I ride the LRT, and it's been my experience that this seating area, though, is usually occupied by individuals with ambulatory disabilities and seniors, individuals using canes, crutches, or having other general mobility limitations. In these instances, I'm not about to ask them to move. And if I don't ask them to move, then I can't flip the seat up. If I can't flip the seat up, I end up sitting in the exit entrance area or in the aisle, thereby blocking traffic and becoming an obstacle to anybody trying to get on or off. The new vehicles also eliminate the companion seating and force individuals who may be traveling together to separate if the companion also needs to be seated. Young children, spouses, friends, caregivers could end up sitting rows away from the individual with the disability. On an evening when my husband and I returned from the Mall of America, the closest available seat was three rows away. Now, this was fine for us. But if I had been medically fragile or if I had been responsible for a young child, that separation would have been completely unacceptable. Before you today, Senate File 2270 will require the Met Council to adopt standards for the design of LRT vehicles that increase access. It'll require that all LRT vehicles ordered after January 1st, 2015, to conform to these new standards. It will require the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee review and approve these standards. And the minimum standards must include two dedicated wheelchair seats per car and companion seating adjacent to those spaces. Now, the Met Council is going to get up here in a minute, and they're going to tell you, hey, these vehicles meet minimum federal standards. And it's true. They do. However, we're concerned, and it's our understanding, that state and federal law has established a principle that you can't lessen accessibility standards. Also, contained in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, 363A.12, access to public transportation, there's a requirement that people with disabilities have full utilization and access to public transportation, such as the light rail transit. For many of us who ride the LRT, it is our position that with the elimination of the dedicated wheelchair seats and the companion seats, this requirement has been violated. It is also our position that the Met Council established a standard for access in the first generation vehicle that they now have an obligation to maintain. Minnesotans with disabilities who use wheelchairs and scooters have a right to expect that when we travel on the LRT, we will have accessible a place to sit, and when we travel with our children, our spouse, our friends or caregivers, we can travel together. Lastly, I just want to say it's our understanding the reason these features were eliminated was because it was the low bid. Thank you. I urge your strong support for this bill, and I urge its passage. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Questions for Ms. Imdick Cross members. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering if the new the newest version of the seating that you said you have to flip the seats. Is there any signage or anything we can do in addition to what you've described, which for me, it's I'm 100% with you, and I apologize for this. If we had known before, I don't think we would have been here, but we're trying to fix that retroactively moving forward. I appreciate your being here. Is there a way to... Is there signage? Is there anything available there? And is there a way that we could improve it to the point that...
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Ms. Imdick-Cross.
Thank you. There is clearly a signage. And there clearly is a recorded message that comes on periodically to remind people to relinquish those seats. But there's two realities. The reality is the, you know, when I ride the LRT, my fellow riders usually have books, they have headsets, and they are totally oblivious to signage, and they certainly aren't listening to the recorded voice. So there's a whole issue of are they going to pay attention and is it the message going to get across? The second reality is this, the signage says that seniors and people with disabilities should have access to this seating. And the last time I came back from a Twins game, and both sides of the aisle were full of people with canes. I wasn't about to ask somebody with a mobility disability to move just because they weren't in a chair. So I blocked the aisle. And as crowded as that was, it was a very uncomfortable situation to be put in.
Thank you.
Thanks. I had a thought, but I'll wait. We have Claudia Fugli here. Welcome to the committee.
Greetings. Can you hear me? Okay.
A little bit closer.
Greetings.
Thank you.
My name's Claudia from Robbinsdale. And just a little thing I want to say. When I use public transportation, I hope to have the same respect as everyone else. Using the LRT is a challenge. If the folding seats are down, I usually have to ask someone to help me bring the seat up. That doesn't always happen. And so I'm finding myself either going in the aisle or at the doors. And if I'm getting on there and I'll find people sitting in those seats, I'm in the aisle or at the doors. And I'm feeling that is a very unsafe, very dangerous situation. There is nothing to hang on to in case something happens. The fast stop, it's a whatever may happen, you know, I just don't have anything to hang on to for balance. And I also am getting very frustrated looks from people who look at me and say, you're in the way. And I know I'm in the way. And you know how hard luggage hits you on the head? I get hit by so many people when I'm in the aisle or at the door. And you got the passengers coming on the light rail or off the light rail, and I'm in their way. I am getting so many frustrated looks and saying, why are you here? They don't tell you that, but you can see it. It makes my life very uneasy as traveling. And so I'm asking that we all look at the situation for accessibility and safety issues. Minnesota has been known to go above and beyond the accessibility issues and beyond the minimum standards for accessibility. Let's not go backwards. This is the future of transportation. We need to look at the transportation of accessibility and safety for everybody, regardless of who we are. And I'm really asking everybody to take a challenge. Use the LRT one day, just one day as I'm asking. Use a scooter, use a wheelchair. Use the LRT on a rush hour time or game time and see what it's like. See what we're asking. See what we're getting into. Because there is nothing that's more frustrating than taking an LRT during the time when it's really busy and you're in the aisle blocking the traffic of pedestrians. You know, the look on people's faces is unbelievable. I wish I had a camera to show you because this is, in a way, a discrimination. This is harassment. They don't tell you anything, but just the looks is harassment. So please consider the accessibility and safety issues of everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fugley. Any questions, members? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, not really a question, just thank you for your testimony. And I
thank you.
I appreciate hearing what you said, and I think it's important. You're not trying to be in the way. It's very uncomfortable to be in the way, and I'm interested to hear what the agency is going to say, because I'm concerned about the cars, but I'm also concerned about how they're marking and making accessibility issues at the stations. And so thank you for coming.
All right. Ms. Imdick Cross, I was going to ask, we've had some meetings and some conversations, so I'm familiar with this. I recall your producing some minutes from a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. that indicated that Met Council staff would return to the committee with some drawings, some designs, kind of confirming that the LRT vehicles would remain largely the same, but the second batch of LRT vehicles would remain the same as the first. Is that the case? Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair, what they did is they gave us the verbal assurance. They never did return with any specific drawings that we could find in minutes that we had reviewed. So what we could find in the minutes was the verbal assurance that the second generation vehicles would be the same as the first generation vehicles. And we received that in the form of at the meeting, and there are several of us who have memories of other assurances that we received, but this one we got right out of the minutes.
Okay, great.
And
thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Right. And members, one of the key differences here, I mean, we know, of course, in buses, the seats are just there and people are sitting in them. It's fairly typical for folks to get up and move when someone with disabilities comes onto the bus. If they fail to move, the bus driver is, 6 feet away.
Exactly.
And they can intervene very, very quickly. And they do. I mean, I've seen young people just sit there like a bump on the log, not responding to the fact that a senior or someone with disabilities is right there. And the bus driver barks at them or gets up and says, taps them on the shoulder. And cause sometimes they're oblivious because they're listening to their music and they're just not paying attention. Sometimes they're just oblivious. But there's someone there to help. In the LRT vehicles, there's no one there to help.
Chair, if I could say, up until this point, folks with mobility issues found the LRT wonderfully accessible and praised it highly for its accessibility. I'm already hearing from people who indicate that they're going to, if this is the seating arrangement, we did get the Met Council to remove one of the bench seats to create some standing space, because it's a lot easier to move standing passengers than it is to remove sitting passengers. And then you have, so we did make a little bit of progress, and that's what we're looking at for the Central Corridor line. But for vehicles that they order in the future, we would like to see the full access. We have people in chairs with children. They don't want to they'd be separated from those their children, their child. They don't want to have to sit rows away. They have a responsibility as a parent. There are so many issues at play here that when you hear the argument that they are ADA compliant, please remember that we often go beyond the ADA minimum requirements. In building code, in service providing, there are lots of instances when we exceed that minimum code. And I think we really need to look at this bill in that light. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Shetnan.
It's good. All is good. It's horrible.
Welcome, Mr. Shetnan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. This is a difficult issue, and I can appreciate the comments of the testifiers, and it's important for me to add that we take this extremely serious, and that is one of the reasons why the previous bill, Senate File 2268, that was just passed a minute ago, the council supports that bill. And we think that the TAC committee, which is the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee, which it is an advisory committee, should be expanded to reflect all of the different modes of transit that we provide at Metro, at the Metro Council and Metro Transit. But as Ms. Cross did mention, that yes, this is an issue that has to do with ADA compliance, but it also has to do with how we bid these for these vehicles. And the LRV vehicle ones, which were our Hiawatha line vehicles, were built by Bombardier. The LRV vehicle 2 was built by Siemens. And so as a public entity who receives federal funding to help provide for the purchase of these, we have to go through a bid process. And we have to go with the lowest responsible bid. And in that, the Siemens bid came in $34 million less. However, so we went with that. However, the access that we had for our ADA compliance was met. And not only that, in our LRV2 vehicle, we actually exceeded that by 100% by having four seats available versus two. And also when we talk about the chairs that are folding down, in our LRV vehicle 2, they fold up. So you have to pull them down. So you shouldn't have that issue. And that is important input that we received from our TAC committee. I also think it's important to add that the TAC committee is not pursuing this bill. This is not the TAC committee. As Mr. Biss was up here before representing the TAC, this is not being brought forward by them. It's being brought forward by Ms. Cross. And we understand that there has been this longstanding issue, but the TAC committee itself is not asking for this authority. And so I am happy to take other questions regarding that, but I think it is important to, again, make sure that the committee understands the procurement process that we have to follow through. We take it extremely, extremely serious when there are these issues, and we're happy to continue the conversations with Ms. Cross and the TAC committee if they would like to do that. But we have offered to make some adjustments. We sent a letter to the TAC committee back in November offering to sit down and talk about a few adjustments that we think would make a significant difference, and we have not heard back from them. And that is, again, going back to November 15th of 2013. So while I appreciate, again, what Ms. Cross is saying, I don't think necessarily given the TAC committee the ability to have veto approval over how the council has to go through the procurement process and decide specifications for our light rail vehicles is the process that the council and Metro Transit wants to move forward with. And for that, we would oppose this bill. But we also, again, I can't state it enough how important this is to us. But it isn't just as easy as moving seats around, because we have taken that to heart and we have made those adjustments that that Ms. Cross has talked about by exceeding what the ADA compliance is. So I think out of fairness to Metro Transit and the council that needs to be shared. And again, it needs to be shared that this is not a request of the TAC committee, rather a few of its members.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Questions, members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cross, do you feel like your concerns have been heard by Met Council and TAC committee?
Ms. Imdick-Cross. And Ms. Imdick-Cross, please describe your role with the TAC and your role with the state of Minnesota.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. I am the accessibility specialist for the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and I have worked for the state for about 25, 26 years. So I've been involved in a vast number of accessibility issues, ranging from, building construction to transportation access to just a wide range of issues. And I have served on TAC, and I am currently serving on TAC. And I can assure you that this is not simply my issue. I did file a complaint with the Met Council when I first discovered that what we were told back in 2010 wasn't what had materialized in 2013. And so, but there are a number of people who are involved in a involved in this issue. Claudia being one of them. I can give you a list of a half a dozen people that are very interested, and there's even more, I think, as they find out how this has changed. But they're and we did receive a letter in November, but it was a letter from Ms. Kirkpatrick's office simply stating, this is what we're going to do. We're going to remove one bench seat. We're not going to do anything with companion seating. And we're going to put a grab bar there so you have something to hang on to. There was no indication that there needed to be a response to that letter. It was simply a letter stating, this is what we're going to do. That was my understanding and the committee's understanding of that correspondence. So the fact that we didn't respond to it doesn't mean, I'm assuming that their fourth quarter, they're going to start taking those bench seats out, one per vehicle, and putting in a grab bar. That's what the letter said that they were going to do. It didn't say that there was any further negotiation that was going to take place. And that's when we thought, well, maybe if we get some language introduced, they'll voluntarily agree to provide greater access in the future. And they're not even interested in that. So I think what we need is simply to figure out greater access. And if it needs to be legislated, then it needs to be legislated.
Mr. Chair?
Senator, Mr. Shetland.
I have to agree with Ms. Cross to a certain extent. What she was told at the TAC committee in May, I believe, of 2010 was factually incorrect. Whoever mentioned that to her had said that these vehicles were going to be basically the same as the vehicles on Hiawatha. It turns out through the procurement process that it didn't, and at some point that should have been communicated clearer. And for that, I apologize. But we do take this very seriously, and I'm just trying to get back to the root of what the bill does, and I understand what you're saying, Ms. Cross, here, but we're just saying that the TAC committee is what this bill does, would have approval and basic veto authority over the council's ability to move forward with the procurement on a light rail vehicle purchase, and we believe that that is just exceeding what the role of an advisory committee should be. And as I stated, Senate File 2268, that expands that to more reflect what type of input we want to see today. We fully support that. And I guess I would like to work with Ms. Cross and the folks who made the offer to do these things, because I think that there may have been a difference of opinion over what was meant to occur versus what is occurring. So if that is the case and there's confusion there, then I am really sorry for that as well. And I need to talk to those folks, because if the TAC, the folks who sent the letter felt that there wasn't a response that was necessary, I'm not sure our folks understood it that way. So you have my word to continue to work with you on that, because it is unacceptable if it's just a communication error.
Thank you. Senator Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm no procurement expert, but to think that $32 million increase is just for the space that was reconfigured, I find that hard to believe. But my question is to my counsel is, what's the hurdle of adding this as a condition of the bid, if we have some more specificity of what we require within that bid? Is that unreasonable? Is that something that I just have a hard time believing that $32 million or whatever the figure you mentioned earlier was this change, or was it, you know, what other factors were at play? But Mr. I don't see it unreasonable to think that we can add this as a condition of a bid of submitting specific requirements that the state of Minnesota wants to see in those cars.
Right. And Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, my understanding of the procurement process, not only was Siemens, who is the largest manufacturer of light rail vehicles in the nation, not only did they have the lower bid, but they also were rated the best technically, which I think that is one of the specifications that go into the bid process. But I have some additional information here. The base manufacturing layout of Siemens LRVs is Judge, much different than that of Bombardier, and that the council had to make the layout changes between LRV 1 and LRV 2 accordingly because they have a different base layout. But to that point, what we did is the design that we brought forward was ADA compliant, and on top of that, we exceeded that with the additional seating capacity. And then on top of that, as I mentioned earlier, as one of the testifiers mentioned, that she has to lift up those seats. In those LRV vehicles, we've taken that input, and they are on a spring where you have to pull them down versus having to lift them up. It was also mentioned about the stickering and letting people know whether that these are seats are for the disability community. And not only do we have that stickering, but as was also mentioned, we have a notice that goes across the scroll on our LRV vehicles, and our driver also every third stop reminds our customers that that these those seats are reserved for folks who need them. So that's where we're at. But Senator Dibble, members, I understand that this is a difficult issue, and that we'd still like to work with Ms. Cross and the folks in the Minnesota Council on Disability. But we just feel that the Senate file goes a little bit farther.
Mr. Shetton, the companion seating issue—that's a pretty big issue. You haven't addressed that.
Yes, the companion seat issue. You know, I've got Mr. Pellegrin here from Metro Transit. He's the director of our rail operations. Maybe he can speak to that. Is that okay?
Right. Well, he's coming forward. Ms. Imdick Cross.
Mr. Chair, the companion seat, as he will tell you, that there are four bike racks. And it was our suggestion through TAC that they eliminate one of the bike racks and put in a companion seat in that location so that if both spaces were used by people with mobility devices, at least there would be a single seat for someone, a child or a caretaker or a spouse to sit in or a friend. And they weren't interested in pursuing that. But that's what we've done from that angle in regard to the that was our recommendation for the companion seats.
Thank you. Mr. Pellegrin.
Thank you. My name is Vince Pellegrin. I'm the chief operating officer at Metro Transit, responsible for light rail, bus, and commuter rail operations. I'm aware of the situation. When we procure a rail car from different manufacturers, all their structures are not the same. And to modify our specifications are essentially performance specifications. If we get too specific, then the federal government says, you know, you're too specific, that is sole sourcing. My fear is that if we got too specific, that we would essentially take some manufacturer out of the game, so to speak. In the procurement process, we want as many manufacturers in the game to promote the competitive process. We believe that the accommodations, the ADA, a lot of engineering has gone into the Americans with Disability Act compliance. I've been in this business for 34 years in California, Title 13. I've done a lot of this work in California 13. Essentially, the Americans with Disability Act is California Title 13. I've worked with the TAC committee since I came here in 1997, implementing low-floor buses, and like we understand, we work with them all the time. However, I can't say right now, if I went to Siemens and say, I need a companion seat right here, they would probably tell me that would require a change in their structure to do that. Essentially, very expensive, and quite possibly is much different than they've done for any other transit agency in the country. Certainly not impossible, but would be extremely expensive to do that. And I'm not sure that their structure could handle it. And we have, there's crashworthiness requirements. There's a lot of technical requirements that go into the seating configuration, the structure of the light rail vehicle, and all that goes along with that. So we believe that four wheelchair parking areas, like Judd said, the seats default up. We're willing to take out the discussion earlier about, I'm aware of the letter where we said we were going to take out one of those spring up seats. We'd certainly be willing to do that, put in the grab bar. We can do that. So we believe that meets the intent of ADA. And again, I can't tell you as I sit here now that every manufacturer could comply with some specification that would be unique to the industry. That would be counterproductive in the procurement process. That's my primary fear.
Thank you. Questions, members? So, Mr. Pellegrin, did you even ask if this could be done? I mean, you had given the TAC some assurance, or someone had given the TAC some assurance that the disabilities area would be the same. Did you even ask Siemens if they could deliver something that was the same?
We believe it is the same.
Mr. Pellegrin, it's clearly actually not the same.
Actually, bigger. What's missing is the so-called companion seat.
So-called? Those are companion seats. They might be the child of the person traveling who needs to sit near them. That's a big deal. Right now, that is just simply not an option for folks who are traveling with other people. That's a big deal.
I understand. Answer your question, Mr. Chair, did we ask Siemens? No. We didn't require it in the specification. We required 4 wheelchair parking areas.
I have a question.
Which is twice the amount that the Americans with Disability Act requires per rail car.
Ms. Imdick-Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just need to underscore one more time, they're not dedicated. They're shared spaces. They're shared areas. Mm-hmm. And all it takes is one pedestrian sitting in that bench seat to block it for anybody who needs it in a mobility device, or another person with a disability using a cane. If that bench seat is down and occupied, then there is no place for a person in a chair or scooter to sit other than the aisle or blocking the entrance exit. Very.
So, Mr. Pellegrin, how much was the final price tag of acquiring these Siemens cars, this block of Siemens cars that we have?
The Siemens cars were $3.3 million per car.
And how many did we buy, and how much is the total procurement?
59 cars.
So what's the math?
Huh? A lot.
A lot. So,
Mr. Chair, how many did he say?
59.
At 3.3 each. 3.3 million each. So, Mr. Shetton, I have a question for you. I see here that when the Met Council makes a procurement of over $125 million, it's to be reviewed by this Legislative Advisory Commission, on which I sit, I believe. Are we doing that? I mean, I don't remember any communication that a procurement of over $125 million was being made, and asking the Legislative Advisory Commission, on which I sit, to review that.
Mr. Chair and members, I will have to check on that. I apologize. I will have to talk to our procurement folks about that. I know that oftentimes it at least involves a letter, and then it's up for the commission to determine whether or not they meet or not. But I will double check on that and send a letter to the or send an email.
This is 473.915.
And Mr. Chair, members, I recall that came from a particular issue related to a bus purchase years back with Senator Clark regarding a New Flyer issue and a Gillig procurement that we had that. And we take that seriously, and Mr. Chair, I'll follow up with you on that if that's okay.
Okay.
I can't recall off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, while he's there, I didn't hear the answer. What was the difference in cost, $3.3 million on these, and the alternative options were how much different?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, the difference was $34 million overall and for the 59 vehicles, but they, one of the other criteria in the procurement had to do with the technical standards and the Siemens vehicle rated best technically.
So Mr. Chair, Mr. Shipman.
Senator Westrom.
The additional cost of $34 million wasn't all because of this accessibility issue, or was that the difference on that issue specifically?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I don't believe that that was in particular the issue. I can certainly find out the details of the procurement, but I would, I'm willing to say that it's most likely not the mobility issue that was the difference on the $34 million. Like I said, with the LRV2 vehicles, we went beyond the ADA requirements and actually added a couple additional seats. And I know that Ms. Cross is saying that they are fold-down seats. And, in fact, they spring up. But, again, we appreciate the fact that you're in a position where if people can't get to those seats that we need to address that. And so we will.
All right. Members, the hour has come. It's 5:31. Actually, that clock's a little fast, so you got 2 minutes, Senator Sandrum. Senator Sandrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to reference line 1.13, and it's not about the accessibility issue. It's about the authority of an advisory committee. And an advisory committee, you know, advising a statutory arm of government, really, and we giving them in this bill approval authority. I wonder what the author thinks about that, and more specifically, if we were to strike and approve the last two words, would that give you great heartburn?
Let me make a suggestion, Senator Sandrum. I had originally thought that we were going to kind of lay this bill on the table and kick it around. This bill does have fiscal implications. My inclination would be to send it to finance, allow this conversation to continue. It would come back to the finance subdivision of this committee, and maybe we'll have some resolution when it appears back in front of us, when we're convened as the finance subdivision of transportation.
Mr. Chair, it would seem to me, and I'm not sure it's up to us to deal with so-called government structure, but it would also seem to me that this bill should go to state and local government if we're going to talk about this, or we ought to handle it here. But
I think it would stay within
structure and the powers of advisory committees. And I would believe that not too many advisory committees have the authority to approve. Above and beyond their parent body.
State and local deals with advisory committees when we establish them, but when we're dealing with their, you know, what they do already established is an already established advisory committee. So it would stay within. I don't think it would go to state and local. I mean, otherwise, every time there's a slight modest adjustment, maybe judiciary wants. That's a joke.
I would simply urge we have more discussion on that at some point. I think it's an important principle that we need to think about.
I agree with you, actually. I think that might be a bridge too far and too much power and authority for this particular advisory committee, but I'd like at least the ability for them to have some opportunity to have a better conversation with the Met Council before we bring it back in front of this group in finance form. It has a fiscal implication. There's a big fiscal note attached to this idea. Which we probably can't afford, frankly. So we need some. So there does need to be some resolution, which we will see again in this committee should that occur. All right. So Senator Carlson, motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to defer to the chair to figure out which committee it would go to.
Finance. Finance, which means finance subdivision. Basically comes back. It's a boomerang.
Transportation.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
finance, and then finance will make the referral down to division. So full finance. All right. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Members, that concludes the business of the committee for today. We are back on Monday. All right, we'll see you. We are adjourned.